Podcasting is brought to you by the Office of University Advancement.
I want to welcome you and tell you how important this is. I'm just delighted to see so many people from so many organizations, and that's part of the reason for this conversation, is for us to remind each other of all the different resources that we all can draw on, and then to help in any way that we can to establish a culture, an ethos of being willing to ask for help, to first of all recognize difficulties any one of us might have on any given day, but be very comfortable to talk about it, get help, resources, and there are all kinds of resources. And that's a large part of what we're doing today, is sharing among ourselves those resources that all come together in so many ways to help. So with that, our Provost, Bear Baker.
I'll just add a few more things to what Tom has said. Obviously, we have a large student body, and we're all responsible for those students in one form or another, or one fashion or another. If you came from a really small school, you probably had faculty that reached out and touched you and you knew personally all the time. If you didn't, if you went to Ohio State or University of California system, you were a number and somebody in a seat. We're someplace in between that. At the same time, I'd say our faculty has fallen out of the habit of reaching out to students as often as they could or should. For all kinds of reasons, including it's not very easy sometimes and can be extremely messy. I applaud what Student Affairs has done, what Bruce's shop has been doing with the CARE team, what the university has been doing with the CARE team, providing an easier way for faculty to engage services when they feel that those services are needed for a student, or perhaps even a colleague, which happens as well. So. I'm here to listen and see what I can do to help, and thank you very much for coming. More people inside said they would come. Definitely not a bad thing. Bruce?
I'd also like to just share a few thoughts in regards to the importance of this meeting this afternoon. And first, I want to thank Pam Kravis and the Chancellor's Office, because the idea for us to come together to have this conversation really comes from Pam, and so I wanted to acknowledge her and for doing the heavy lifting with today's event. So when we started having the conversation about what does a healthy minds ethos look like, or what would that look like, we started talking about the work that is done on this campus among researchers, faculty, clinicians, and practitioners, and also other key stakeholders who are very concerned about the welfare of our students, and we realize that there's great work happening throughout this campus. Just take, for example, even NCBI, the work that Margot Watson does with the NCBI team. What a great tool that is to bring conversation to this campus community about how we're doing with one another. And so as we talked about that and the value of having this conversation, we came to this ultimate goal of wanting to improve the lives of our students, the living and learning environment for our students, our faculty, and our staff. That's really our ultimate goal here today. So my role as the Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs, of course, I'm very concerned about the welfare of our students, particularly those who are exhibiting mental health concerns. And what we are seeing, as our trends are indicating, is that we're seeing more students exhibit moderate to serious mental health concerns than we've ever seen before on this campus. So when we look at indicators, of course, you can be a clinician and you know what your numbers look like as far as what are the issues that you're dealing with inside of a clinic. But we also look at some other indicators. For example, the CARE team that the provost had mentioned, that the CARE team's been up and running in various forms for 3 years. And this last year, we had 91 more CARE team reports than we did 3 years earlier, with 236 reports having been submitted. So that's a significant increase. When we look at student misconduct and code of conduct violations, last year we had 381 students violate the student code of conduct. We think about violations of endangerment, assault, and infliction of physical harm, that we had 40 students violate that policy last year. And then we know that alcohol and drugs is a particular interest area for some students. And that number seems to go up and down depending on the year. We had a high of around 243 six or seven years ago, alcohol violations. Last year it was 123. And the year right before last year, it was 210. And so I just wanted to acknowledge that we have a new health alcohol and drug educator on campus working in the Dean of Students office, Sierra Mills. And I think that her work definitely impacts student behavior by being proactive. So thank you, Sierra. So obviously students with mental health concerns, they really impacts the campus community in many different ways. We look at and think about disruptions that occur inside and outside the classroom. We know that that students who are exhibiting mental health concerns are more prone to violence. And the interesting thing about the violence aspect is when they finally act out on that violence, that's not the first time that others have been aware that this individual might have had concerns or might be dealing with some issues. So we're given notice by the students. Poor academic performance, of course, is a big concern for us, because why are we all here? And we also think about roommate conflicts in the residence halls. We think about alcohol and drug abuse in use, and then suicide as well. So we know that college students represent an exceptional risk population. And for example, drug overdoses are now the number one cause of death in the United States. And where does drug and alcohol addiction most often begin? In the ages between 18 and 25, our college population. The national average for frequency of depression among college students is around 25%, one in four students. We know from research that we've done here at UAA that 8.5% of our students have considered suicide, and 1% have seriously considered suicide within the last 2 weeks. We know that 18% of our students have reported intentionally cutting, burning, bruising, or otherwise injuring themselves. 18%. So needless to say, we have our hands full. And just to throw on top of that is that we're operating at a time when significant federal oversight by way of mandates is further reducing our ability to use our resources as effectively as what we'd like, because we're spending a significant inordinate amount of time responding to federal mandates. Within student affairs, we spend nearly $1 million annually to provide either direct mental health services to students or to manage and respond to student behaviors. An additional $500,000 we spend on staff who provide caring and engaging environments for students in crisis, such as our staff in the residence halls, or Nicole Grunewald, our military and veterans resource assistant. And 12% of the student affairs budget, that is. So when we put those two numbers together, that's 12% of our budget is focused on ensuring students are living and learning in a safe and healthy environment. And then it's worth noting that about two-thirds of that entire expenditure is actually covered by the student health fee that students are required to pay. So don't mean to leave it on a down note, but we've got a serious conversation to have here this afternoon. And I'm really pleased that we have so many individuals at all different levels in the organization, our researchers, our faculty, our administrators, our frontline staff, to share in this conversation, to think about what would UAA look like 5 years from now if we truly had a healthy minds ethos throughout campus. I'd also be remiss if I just didn't recognize the wonderful staff, the frontline staff who are here from Student Affairs, Administrative Services, Office of Academic Affairs, who are dealing with students who are in crisis and have concerns on a regular basis. I want to make sure that you know that I appreciate the work that you do. And with that, then, we'll go on to our first presenter, which is our new Director of Student Health and Counseling Center, Georgia DeKaiser. Georgia.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you for all of you for being here, and I so appreciate the introductions from Chancellor Case and Provost Baker and Dr. Schultz, because I noticed that they use a we language. It's not just them and us, it's we, and we can all succumb to mental illness at some level. So some of you may recognize this picture. It was taken by the Daily News about a year ago, and it was taken on our quad, 1,100 red flags that represent the number of college students nationwide who are thought to have completed a suicide on a campus the year before. They put this on the front page of the paper above the fold. So it's not only this community that cares about the well-being of each other, but it's our city too. So we're very fortunate there. So I'd like to talk to you just a bit about what we do at the health center. We're an integrated physical and mental health primary care clinic. We see about 10,000 individual visits per year. 70% of those are physical health visits, 30% are mental health visits, and among the 30% of the mental health visits, approximately 45% of those individuals take medications. We are staffed by psychiatric nurse practitioners, licensed professional counselors, licensed clinical social workers. We also have student interns from the School of Nursing and the School of Clinical Psychology. We have a consulting psychiatrist who is available by telephone. Mobile phones are great. The guy, I swear, he calls me from the ski slope. So he's really a great resource for us. And he's on campus 2 hours a week, 2 hours every other week, but available by phone. So how do we do what we do at the health center? Just as Dr. Schultz says, we try to be immediately available to students. It's very difficult to call or to walk in and say, I'm not doing very well. None of us likes to say that. So when a student walks in or calls, we strive to have them meet with a professional for at least 15 or 20 minutes to listen to the story, to find out how they're doing, ask if they're going to class, how they're sleeping, are they eating, what are their support systems, how much alcohol are they using, are they suicidal, are they homicidal, and how do they cope, and what's next? So we make a plan with these students. Depending upon the need that's presented, we refer internally in the university. There might be some other resources that are available that might be a good fit with that student's needs, or we refer out. And then the third avenue is to continue on in the health center with a clinical appointment. And those appointments last 90 minutes. It's a psychiatric evaluation. At the end of that, we use a strengths-based counseling model. It's called solution-focused therapy. And when I was doing clinical work, this was my favorite part, because after you listen to somebody for 90 minutes and they tell you quite a few intimate details, you get to tell them what their strengths are. And it's just so much fun. And you watch them just get taller and bigger, and maybe the day isn't quite as bad as they thought it was. But so that's the type of therapy we use. It's a cognitive behavioral, brief, solution focused. We use that and medications and a combination of those together. Never force a student to go on medications. That's their choice, but we talk to them about what medications might do for them. Because we're an integrated clinic, the physical health part is right there. Oftentimes we recommend a physical exam, which is free, with some labs. We continue in therapy support, counseling support, and then make a plan to exit when the time is right. We do this in the context of who the students are, and these are some of the developmental tasks that college students are challenged with, and there's a lot right there. The other context we're always aware of are the emerging mental illnesses, and we know that depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, and bipolar are illnesses that rise at a level in late adolescence and early young adulthood. These illnesses can be exacerbated by something as simple as irregular sleep, poor nutrition, and certainly drugs and alcohol. Stress is a big one too that can worsen these illnesses. students, more and more students are coming to us with established diagnoses, and I think this is related to the support that they get in grade school, middle school, and high school, and so they achieve to a point where college is an appropriate next step for them. So the American College Health Association did a survey last spring, 120,000 students, and these were the areas that they identified difficulties in. So what are we seeing at the health center? About 40% of our student visits are depression related, 16% are anxiety related, 29% are attention deficit related, but this percentage is a little bit skewed because we have these students come back every month. When they're receiving a controlled substance, which the psychostimulants are, we know that there's a 9 to 30% diversion rate of those medications on campus. And so we do a lot of work around educating them, telling them that, you know, if they would sell this medication, that's a felony, that we do drug testing, they sign a drug contract. So we take it quite seriously, and that's why that number is a little bit higher. And then the other categories are bipolar illness, which is a very treatable mental illness, and then 10% things like roommate problems, insomnia, my dog died, which can be a real crisis for students, things like that. Okay, so how are we different as compared to our community? We're certainly cost effective. A student pays $8 a credit, and it doesn't cost anything to come and see us. It only costs them something if they miss their appointment, and then we charge them $15 for a missed appointment. Compare that to the psychiatric ED. And then as we get further down on the columns, there's the availability of mental health services in our community is really sparse. So at Province Behavioral Mental Health Group, medical group, they're not taking any new medication appointments at this time. And then a private practice on the far left there, almost a 3 to 4 week wait for an appointment. So we are cost effective and we're available. So lots of statistics. I'd like to close with a few quotes. And I just pulled these out of some charts without patient identifiers. But you can read them. Well, I'll read the top one and you can read the rest of them. I can't sleep. It's hard to concentrate. Tired all the time. Depression is coming back. I want to get back on medications to stop the downward spiral. When my depression gets really bad, it helps to have unbiased support. My depression affects my schoolwork. I failed a test last week. I never failed tests. I'm thinking about shooting myself. This was a phone call. No, no, I don't have a gun. No, I'm not planning to find a gun. Yes, I can come right away to the health center. Yes, I understand. If I don't come, you'll call my dad. This was an English major that wrote this. I'm so lonely, I feel like a single raindrop in a thunderstorm. I'm worried about my future. I just called to say goodbye to you because I promised I would, and APD was called and located the student. Over the weekend, someone gave me spice. I still don't feel good. It was scary. They called the police because I was paranoid. I had to go to the hospital. I never want to go through that again. So we could fill up the whole room with those kind of statements. But the good news is this is a caring community, and I really appreciate you guys. And I'm really glad that we're here, and there's work to be done. Thank you.
Our next short presentation is from Dr. Dewan Lee, our Dean of Students, Associate Vice Chancellor of Student Development, and then Lisa Terwilliger, who is our Care Team Coordinator.
We got to get our presentation up.
Okay. Okay, great. So Lisa and I will talk to you a little bit about what we're seeing through the Dean of Students Office and specifically through the CARE team, and you've heard mention of the CARE team, and we'll just briefly mention it in our presentation, but if you have not had a presentation to your staff or your division regarding the CARE team, please contact myself or Lisa, and our contact information will be here. This presentation will touch briefly on what we do through the CARE team, but it will probably be very worthwhile that you all have a full presentation on the CARE team so that you can be a part of the work that we're doing. So specifically, we're going to talk about what we are seeing, the scope of what we're seeing, and our response through the Dean of Students Office and the CARE team. Now, the American Psychological Association has identified these as student mental health issues across college campuses. And this is not anything different for our campus here. We are seeing these in varying levels. When we do see these types of behaviors, we identify these students as students of concern or concerning behaviors. And we do publish a report, and if you have not seen it, it's on our website, and we have a couple of copies that you may want to take a look at. And what it does is it classifies the concerns that we have for our students on our campus, the behaviors that are concerning to us, and the behaviors that inhibit their ability to be successful on our campus. And so we outline what those behaviors are, the numbers, the frequency, and how we have responded to those in this report. So Lisa will talk to you about the students of concern, the behaviors we are seeing, so what we are seeing, and the frequency of it.
I just want to echo what Georgia said. We are a very, very caring community here, and I have the privilege of being part of a team that is proactive, and that's what's so exciting about the CARE team. And I wanted just to take this opportunity to share how we're reaching out to students here. The students that we engage with in the CARE team come to us through three different avenues, through the conduct process, which, you know, when university officials get the attention of students because they're violating something, usually drug or alcohol or academic issues, or through the Title IX investigation process. Stephanie Whaley and Jerry True head that up, and that's addresses domestic violence and sexual misconduct in which investigators work to protect the victim and allow the accuser the right to participate in the process. But lastly, what we're talking about is the CARE team referral and report process, which employs bystander awareness and a promotion of community concern. And I just want to give a shout out to Caitlin Poindexter, who's here, who helped develop with Liz Shine, the whole concept of sense something, say something, do something. That's what I'm going out to promote now, and she set me up to be able to do that, to go out and promote that if anybody in the community senses something's wrong with a student, that they contact us, they say something to us, and we'll do something. So these students who are identified here are not students who seek intervention on their own. They're not the students that walk into the Student Health and Counseling Center, which takes a whole lot of courage to do. They're students who haven't had the courage, or they're not ready to ask for help, but they need intervention. And so they're identified by the community, by staff, faculty, other students. As the student of the Handbook of Campus Threat Assessment and Management team says, the earlier a concern is reported to the team, the easier it is to address and resolve. Early identification allows for a broader range of intervention options, especially those that are less punitive and less control oriented. So we can really bring support around the student. There's tons of support on this campus. So last year, our data showed that the top three concerns that we had out of the 236 reports shown were a concern for well-being, and that number is not right. It should be 28 students. And those issues that came to us for their concern for their well-being were suicide ideation, homelessness, economic issues, not being able to pay for things, extreme illness that caused absenteeism, difficulties at home with relationships, to include domestic violence. So you hear in all these issues, you can see how conduct and Title IX come in. And so those conduits, we partner greatly in our office and work with each other on how to support these students. Secondly, students were referred for disruptive behavior, and you'd think that's a conduct issue, right? And Michael would say, yes, it is. But but usually the behavior is impacting the classroom, a public place, or the residential community, but that behavior starts somewhere else. I mean, it originates with something. And to get to the bottom of it is what, so it doesn't happen again, and so the student doesn't escalate into even a bigger threat to the campus or a threat to themselves, is what our goal is. And the last one is, thirdly, 18 students were referred to for mental health and behavioral issues. Of course, the same kind of issues that you hear about in the Student Health and Counseling Center, but they're not seeking help themselves. They're letting somebody else know through Facebook, through a tweet, through just a writing to their professor that they're you know, thinking about hurting themselves. So, and it's also about extreme anxiety, depressive statements, not eating, isolating, and even harassing other students because they don't know how to get attention. So those kind of things are mental health behavior issues. So you can see the students we address cover a wide swath of different behaviors and different concerns, but we rely on the community to tell us, and then we go reach out to these students. So now Dr. Lee is going to talk about how our referrals and reports, how we process those.
Okay, and before we get into it, we talked about the increasing numbers. So you can just see how our numbers are increasing, starting from 2010 with 145 reports to 2013, 236. And the follow-up is important because that's the care that we provide to the students. How many people from our office make additional contacts with those individuals that are in those reports, and how many referrals are made. So how do we do this? The care team meets 1 hour each week to discuss cases that has come before us. It's made up of individuals from various departments. We've got the Associate Dean of Students, Dawn Dooley. He also serves as the chair. Raise your hand, Dawn. Michael Vitava, our conduct person, because we've talked about the intersection of the mental health and those concerning behaviors with conduct. Chief of Police, Rick Schell. We've got Georgia DeKaiser, the director of the Health Center and Counseling Center. Dr. Ryan Henney, director of Res Life. Bridget. Lisa Terwilliger, who is the care team coordinator. So Lisa will take the reports, do an initial review, and then bring the information to the care team for discussion. We've got Dr. Mason, who is the counselor liaison to the faculty and counselor to our students, and Sierra Mills, student success counselor assigned to the residential community right here. So every member of the care team has attended and been trained in a behavioral risk management training conducted by NCIRM, which is the National Center for Risk Management in Higher Education. And as a result of that, we have focused on specific things that are a concern for us. And specifically, we have three primary objectives. That's safety, prevention, and response. It's the safety of the individual, but also the safety of the community. Prevention. We want to prevent a reoccurrence of behaviors, and if possible, prevent behaviors from escalating within the classroom, within the residential community. Any of the behaviors, if we know about them in advance, we can take on a preventative measure, which is why having Lisa come to your divisions and departments to do a full explanation and presentation of the care team would be important, because it helps us in the prevention stage. You will learn how to identify behaviors and how to report those to us before it gets to the last level where we have to respond. And of course, we're prepared and we're ready to respond, but if we can stay in this prevention area, that would be our preference. So I mentioned that we've all been to risk management training, and a part of the risk management training is that we have all been trained and know how to use a threat assessment tool. We specifically use this one, which is the tool of NABITA, which is the National Association of Behavioral Threat Association. And the scale or tool has three levels. The middle is the generalized risk level.
one side we have the aggression scale, and on the other side we have the D scale. And I'll just quickly go through each of them because this is the tool that we use when a student is presented to us with some concerns. So in the middle is the generalized level of risk, starting from mild all the way to extreme. And mild could be something as simple as disruptive behaviors in the class, not too concerning, but talking out of turn, constantly raising hands, but somewhat disruptive to the other students in the classroom. Then we go to moderate risk, where those disruptions become more frequent. Then we've got elevated risk, where it is severely disruptive to the class. It disables other people from learning. There could be some level of threat, but a vague threat involved. Severe risk, threats are made. Severely disruptive to the learning process, to the classroom, to the residential community. And then we've got the extreme risk at the very top, where we have to take immediate action. Those behaviors are very concerning, and the individual has de-escalated and has gone far beyond where they would normally operate on a day-to-day basis. And this scale allows us to identify where a student is with their normal behavior. And if they're way off, then we know that there are some concerns that we need to address immediately. Now, once we've kind of looked at the risk level, we also like to determine, has this person been referred to us because they are a risk or harm to themselves, or a risk or harm to self, or harm to others? So on the left side, we have the aggression scale, which is used for individuals who are a threat or harm to others. And it identifies three phases: the trigger phase, the escalation phase, and the crisis phase. Now, within each of those phases, there are some sub-phases that identifies the individual's level of risk and the increasing of their behavior. And I'll just go over some of those quickly so you'll see some of the things that we take a look at. So initially, there's a trigger phase down here at the bottom, which doesn't really hit any of these phases, but there's a trigger. Georgia mentioned the death of a pet. Divorce of parents. Anything could be a trigger. And once that trigger is sparked, then a student may rise to these levels. So a level one, particularly hardening, the aggressor becomes distant and argumentative. And this could show itself in the classroom. Professors may notice students are distancing themselves. They're not making eye contact. They're not involved. They're not engaged. And there are other levels, level two and level three. The next phase, where students become highly escalated, is levels four and five. Now, the fourth level is image destruction. So remember, this is someone who is a harm to someone else. So at the fourth level, the image destruction, I'm fixated on Lisa. And so what I'm going to do is try to destroy her image with people who respect her, people who like her, because I want to gain the respect and have those people like me. And I'm upset with Lisa that they like her, or some other reason Lisa has upset me, and so I'm out to destroy image. At the fifth level, it's the same thing, but increasing. I'm gonna do a little bit more to disparage her and to destroy her image. Professors may see this in class as one student trying to deliberately embarrass another student in class, doing some things that will really put this person in a bad light. Level six, threat strategies, where threats are starting to formulate. Levels seven and eight, and level seven, limited destruction. So I am not really gonna do something, but I'm gonna rally other people around to do something. Level eight, it's a win-lose. I am thinking that I'm gonna do some bodily harm to her, but my intent is to survive this. So some kind of way I'm gonna harm her, but I'm gonna get away with this scot-free because Michael will not know that I've done this. Level nine is the highest one, where there's real concern. Then on the other side is the D scale, where there is a threat or harm to self. And we take a look at this one through three levels. The initial level is distress, where the student is showing some emotional disturbance. The disturbance level is behaviorally, they're being disruptive, very unusual, bizarre acting, substance abusing. And at the top, the dysregulation or medically disabled level. Now, To be clear, this is a medical term, such as a psychotic break. It's not a federal term or federal regulation as someone being disabled. And at this level, someone is suicidal. They may be engaging in high-risk behaviors, hostile and aggressive. So depending on where a student falls in the risk level and what side of the scale they fall on, we identify the information that we have, we analyze it, we look at the resources available, and we make referrals as necessary for those students in order to lower that risk level and get them to mild or moderate. But the ideal is mild or where there is no risk at all. So that's generally how the care team operates. There's a referral process, and we also have a link on our website to submit a report. So thank you. And again, if you're interested and want to get more information about the care team or more information on how we assess threat, risk, and levels, feel free to contact the NEMA Students Office.
Now I'd like to turn it over to our dean from the College of Health, Bill Holder.
Right, thank you, Bruce. I didn't prepare anything as far as a PowerPoint because I had 2 minutes. So let me just highlight a couple of things. I want to also thank the Chancellor and the Provost for introducing today's event, and I particularly want to thank Pam as well for pulling this together. I think I've said this to a couple people, but this topic is sort of in my wheelhouse, so to speak. I was a clinical social worker for a number of years. I've had the privilege of being the director of community mental health centers, and at one point I was the director of behavioral health for the state. So I think I certainly understand the issue. And I guess if one thing I want to say to the group is, if going forward you need access to resources beyond the university system, I still have a bunch of contacts statewide, nationally, in fact, internationally, that we might be able to benefit from. So one of the terms you're going to hear me use is behavioral health. And when I use that term, what I'm simply referring to is people who have both a mental health and a substance use problem. So when I was with the state, one of the things we discovered was that about 2/3 of all people who were accessing or trying to access services actually had both problems, and frequently had both problems at the same time. And I'm almost certain that the folks over at Student Health and Counseling run into this all the time. So it's not clearly somebody coming in who's anxious and depressed. In all likelihood, they may be self-medicating with alcohol and drugs, as an example. So behavioral health is a big deal in our college, and as the Chancellor indicated, because we're the health campus, we do a lot to prepare students to be practitioners, not only in the current health and behavioral health delivery system, but the health and behavioral health system for the future. So all of the schools, departments, centers, institutes in our college really reference or talk about behavioral health on occasion. So that's the Center for Human Development, the Department of Health Sciences and Human Services, the Justice Center, the Schools of Allied Health, Nursing, Social Work, WAMI, and our Institute of Circumpolar Health. So one of the things, I guess the theme, there's three themes that I've heard already today. One is caring, and I would absolutely agree we have a caring community. The second is connectedness. The Chancellor mentioned this, and I think it's important that people feel connected and feel like they can go to someone for the kinds of help that they might need. That's a big deal. And the third is collaboration, and we've worked really hard within our college to collaborate with many of our colleagues, particularly in the College of Arts and Sciences and in the College of Education. A couple of examples is that we developed an interdisciplinary behavioral health course with Arts and Sciences and Education entitled Critical Behavioral Health Issues. It involves social work and psychology, school counseling, and nursing. We've developed a children's mental health minor and graduate certificate. We've developed a marriage and family therapy graduate certificate in conjunction with social work, clinical psych, counselor education, and yes, even UAF, our colleagues at UAF in community counseling. There is something within the UA system called the Behavioral Health Alliance. We are working with our many colleagues throughout the UA system on what should we be paying attention to in behavioral health, and how can we create curriculum to better serve our students and potentially the citizens of Alaska. There's one thing I want to advocate for before I introduce my two colleagues, and that is something called mental health first aid. Anybody ever heard of it? Okay, good. That's a good sign, because I think the whole sense something, say something, do something is really built on that model. But there are folks over in the Center for Human Development actually are at this point are doing statewide trainings in mental health first aid for communities. And the whole notion here is to reduce the stigma of mental illness, to enable people to have some confidence to reach out when they see somebody experiencing a problem, and then to make sure that that person's getting the kinds of services he or she might need. And so I think it's something that's perhaps it's a little more formal than what we've established here within the university system, but I think it is something that's going to help communities throughout the state of Alaska. Now, one of the things that we focused on within the college is research, particularly interdisciplinary research. And we've even gone so far, some people say we've been bold enough, to identify four research domains within our college. The first is trauma. Childhood trauma, intergenerational trauma, and historical trauma, particularly in the Alaska Native community. And so one of the things that we've paid a lot of attention to is what's called adverse childhood experience. This notion that if you experience, your mom had an alcohol problem, your dad was mentally ill, your dad was in prison, you were sexually abused as a child, you were physically abused as a child. If you had four or more adverse childhood experiences, then the likelihood that you're going to experience mental health and substance abuse problems goes up dramatically. It also increases the likelihood that you're going to have diabetes and heart disease and cancer. So it's pretty amazing stuff, and we're beginning to embed adverse childhood experiences into our curriculum and to focus on that in research. One of the other major areas that we want to focus on is substance abuse in research. And so joining me this afternoon, we have two of our young research stars, is how I would describe Gabe Garcia and Marty Rivera. Gabe is with the Department of Health Sciences, and Marty is with the Justice Center. So with that, Gabe, you want to go first?
Good afternoon, everyone. Now, before I talk about my research, just wanted to give you some context about who I am. So I'm Gabriel Garcia, Philippine-born, Alaska-grown, and a 1.5-generation Filipino-American. And so I think with that description, you sort of get why I do what I do in terms of research. And I came here to UAA because I wanted to make a difference in my community. And the way I define my community is the way I define myself. And so the first research that I'll talk to you about is bullying among Anchorage High School students. And I'm sure bullying also occurs here in our college campus. So let me show you that, before I begin showing you my results, I just wanted to acknowledge my partners, the Anchorage United for Youth, the Anchorage Youth Development Coalition, and United Way. So here in our Anchorage High School, there's about 26% that have reported being bullied in school or electronically. And that's an underestimate because it's not socially desirable to admit that a person is being bullied. And why are we worried? Why are we concerned about bullying? Because it lowers self-esteem, increased absenteeism, depression, dropping out of school, and decreased capacity to learn. So who are at risk for being bullied in Anchorage High School? Minority, freshmen, and girls. And in my research, what I found to be negative outcomes associated with bullying are the use of illegal substances and drinking alcohol among high school students. But there are some protective factors. If teachers care and are encouraging, students are less likely to report being bullied. And if school has clear consequences for the behavior, they report less likely to be being bullied. So now let me talk to you about my second research. And my second research is about health of Asians and Pacific Islanders in three Alaskan communities. In Alaska, Asians make up the second largest minority group after Alaskan Natives, Asians and Pacific Islanders. And I want to acknowledge the people that helped me with this research, particularly my co-investigators, Dr. Mapai and Dr. David. Dr. Mapai is from journalism communication, and Dr. David is from psychology. Just wanted to show you that this is a multidisciplinary research. And this research was also conducted with the help of students like Yesenia, Mu, and Anastasia. So this is a map, a census map of 2010, and as you can see, on the upper right, on my upper right, on your left, in Alaska, there are parts where there are 20% or more Asians or Pacific Islanders. And actually, in Dutch Harbor, Filipinos are the largest minority group. The three communities that I did my research were Kodiak, Barrow, and Anchorage. Those three places have more than 10% Filipinos in their population. And by the way, by 2025, one out of four Alaskans are going to be either Asians or Pacific Islanders. Okay, so what are our key findings related to mental health in our research? We found that less established Asian and Pacific Islander immigrants compared to more established peers have lower levels of social support. We also found that they are more fearful of their neighborhood environment. Secondly, Filipinos compared to other Asian and Pacific Islanders more often perceive that people think they are not smart, and that other Asian and Pacific Islanders compared to Filipinos more often have felt so depressed that nothing could cheer them up. And finally, Asian and Pacific Islander men compared to women more often perceive that people are afraid of them. So these are just a few findings from our research. And I just wanted to also give a little bit of context with this research. Some of our respondents are actually college students too. So you can also make that translation to our college campus. So thank you, that concludes my research.
Further evidence that Gabe is truly a research star. He was my co-investigator in this project that I'm going to talk about today. Excuse me. So I'm Marnie Rivera from the Justice Center, and I'm going to talk about this project that Gabe and I worked on, presenting some of the health correlates of female victimization to you today. When we talk about these health correlates, we're not talking about the direct injuries resulting from violent victimization. Instead, we're actually talking about some of the physical health problems that manifest as a result of some of the mental health problems like stress associated with victimization. So in the literature, other folks have examined some of these health correlates as well, and we found a number of different health problems associated with violent victimization. Most of these studies have been done with women, so violence against women. So a number of problems including cardiovascular problems, diabetes, bowel symptoms including irritable bowel syndrome, gynecological problems, as well as some other more general indicators like poor general mental health, poor general physical health, taking up more sick days, increased use of medical care, but reporting difficulty accessing medical care for these needed medical problems. And then a host of other symptoms have been significantly correlated with victimization, including pain, headaches, fatigue, sleep disorders, breathing disorders, and then some of these mental health symptoms like anxiety, stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression. And generally what researchers have found is that the more and more severe forms of violence that women have experienced, the more symptoms and the more severe symptomology they also report as negative health consequences of that victimization. So we looked at Alaska Victimization Survey data from 2010. This is a statewide survey. This is a telephone survey of women in Alaska. And this survey asks a number of behaviorally specific items about experiencing violence. And so what we did is we've collapsed a number of those different behaviorally specific items into composite measures. And so, for instance, we looked at intimate partner violence, or you might be more familiar with the term domestic violence, as well as sexual violence. We have different categories, including alcohol-involved sexual violence, as well as forced sexual violence. And we collapsed those together to be any type of physical violence. We also looked at some other forms of behavior that are associated with intimate partner violence, but may not be directly violent in terms of physical violence, including psychological aggression, coercive control, and harassment. And we had a number of different physical and mental health outcomes that we were examining in relationship with these experiences with violence. So we used logistic regression to examine the odds that a woman who reported being a victim of violence would report having one or more of these health problems relative to women who did not report being a victim of violence. And what we found is that for just about every negative health outcome that we saw, there was a significant relationship with women who were victims of violence. In other words, these women who were victims of violence had increased likelihood of reporting their mental health as fair or poor, reporting their physical health as fair or poor, chronic pain, frequent headaches, difficulty sleeping. The only items that we found that were not significantly associated with being a victim of violence were these couple down here that are not bolded. In other words, there's a lot of negative consequences, physical and mental health consequences associated with being a victim of violence. We took this a step further and we looked at race as an additional variable. And so here what we did was we compared minority women who experienced violence and Caucasian white women who experienced violence to white women, Caucasian women who did not experience violence. And what we saw is that these negative health outcomes were even worse for minority women who had experienced violence. They were significantly more likely to report these negative health outcomes, fair or poor physical and mental health, high blood pressure and irritable bowel syndrome, chronic pain and frequent headaches as a result of being victims in relation to white women who did not experience those problems. And so we looked to allostatic load theory to explain this relationship, and with the idea that experiencing violence is a stressful event, and so this stress again manifests in some physical problems in the body, but this may be even worse for minority women who are already have stress in their lives associated with being minorities, and then this is further compounded by having this additional violence in their life. The other thing I wanted to mention is that when we looked at some of these physical health indicators and mental health indicators, the odds of having negative mental health outcomes are even greater than the odds of the physical health outcomes, which is more directly relevant to what we're talking about today. So our suggestions are to try at all odds to reduce violence against women, and then we'll reduce these negative consequences associated with that victimization. Additionally, we could do some more screening in the medical community to detect some of these symptoms, these physical and mental health problems that are associated with victimization, and try to reduce the stress and anxiety associated with victimization before it leads to further health problems, mental health problems, or physical, and to form interdisciplinary teams that can provide a trauma-informed response to victims of violence, including referrals for healthcare, other supports, legal advocacy, and safety planning. So, I was given 5 minutes. That's my brief summary, and thanks for your participation in today's event.
Next, we have two special guests that are with us this afternoon. They happen to be UAA students from the Active Minds organization. So to introduce Jessica Pacini and Elizabeth Williams, who are going to tell you about the organization.
Hello, my name is Jessica Pacini. I am the president of Active Minds here at UAA. We are a student-run club, and we basically focus on trying to change the conversation about mental health and mental illnesses. We try to raise awareness about how common mental illness is. Someone mentioned earlier, 1 in 4 adults, college students, are diagnosable with a mental illness, so that's something, unfortunately, is common. But we're trying to basically reduce the stigma that's associated with people, feeling as if they're going to be stigmatized for having a mental illness and not being afraid to reach out for help. We partner with ISPI here on campus frequently when we do events, and we also started working with Care Team, and we also mentioned, of course, student health and counseling, the services that are offered there as well. So that's just kind of the gist of what we do.
And I'm Elizabeth Williams. I'm the club representative for Active Minds, and I want to talk a little bit about what we've done this year and also what we hope to do in the future with Active Minds. This semester, what we've done is we've done Eating Disorder Awareness Week in February, where we did a week of tabling with information and resources about eating disorders, and felt like that was a really successful event. We had a lot of people come and talk with us, and it was a really interesting conversation to have, and it's something that maybe doesn't get talked about as much. And with that, we also did a healthy body image message board where people could write positive messages about themselves or just positive messages for other people, and that was really successful. And then this week we're doing Stress Less Week, so we're doing tabling around the campus, including the residential campus, with resources and information about stress and the negative effects of stress, and also how you can combat stress, especially during finals week. And one thing that we're trying to emphasize with Stress Less is laughter and the benefits of laughter. And so with that, we're doing a comedy event tomorrow night where we're bringing in a local comedian, and we're also doing a student competition for stand-up comedy. And Thursday night we're doing a free yoga class. So that's just kind of an example of the kind of events we are currently doing, and we only hope to increase that in the coming years with just doing positive, fun things for students to be involved in, where they can also learn about resources and feel connected on the campus. Oh, and one thing, sorry. I wanted to mention, last week we were interviewed by Fox News and a couple of our club members about what we're doing as a club. And so we were on the 6 o'clock Fox News. So we felt really honored to be publicized like that.
Thank you. And Dean Stalby from College of Arts and Science is going to share a little bit of information about the work happening in CIS.
I have to apologize to start with. I didn't make enough handouts, but I was told 50, I made 60, and there's too many of these. So that's the good news. When Pamela contacted us about this, and I looked up the idea of healthy mind. So if you Google, or at least today when I Googled, or the other day when I Googled healthy mind, I've got a few more over here if there are some back there. The very first thing that pops up is actually images. And the very first image is a brain lifting weights. And that actually reminded me that we're at an institution that is proactively addresses healthy minds. Healthy minds in terms of minds that we exercise intellectually, healthy minds that we promote healthy minds by engaging our students in community activities, so we're doing public good. Healthy minds in that we socialize our students to interact with diverse populations. So we have a tendency, and we've talked about it, to think about healthy minds as being all intervention. But I want to remind us, and I want us to remember, that we're in an environment that really is always promoting healthy minds in a proactive way. Yes, we do have to do interventions. And actually, some of the what I handed out to you, two of our programs are about intervention, and they're going to talk to you today about that. But two other programs that are not going to be talked about today, the two lower programs, are our Clinical Community Health PhD program. It's a joint PhD program with UAF. But it's based on the idea of using wellness, promotion of wellness, of mental health wellness, and the values that are in our cultures and in our communities to help promote that. And ANCAP is an association to help promote and encourage Alaska Native students to go into healthcare, and specifically into behavioral healthcare. And that is also looking at the idea of promoting wellness. And so I think, again, I want to encourage us to think about how we can promote wellness as well as the very important things that we do and we've been talking about today with regard to intervention. And with that, I'm going to turn that over to my colleagues. I have Bridget Hansen and Rebecca Robinson that are going to talk about two of our programs. think Bridget's going to go first.
Okay. Good.
And everyone, it's nice to see so many friendly and encouraging faces. My name is Bridget Hansen. I'm at the Center for Behavioral Health Research and Services, and over there we do a lot of program evaluation projects and training programs, and one in particular that we've had since August of 2011 is called the Integrated Suicide Prevention Initiative. We've been funded by SAMHSA along with a generous match from different organizations as part of UAA to provide training and stigma reduction activities on campus. So how many of you have seen those giant posters or the smaller ones that have the little stick figures that say, you know, if you're concerned about your friend, ask them, or if you're having muddled thoughts, reach out? And so that's part of our stigma reduction campaign on campus. We've also done nearly 100 different student events over the past about 2.5 years, really reaching out to students to increase their awareness of suicide prevention activities and mental health wellness more generally, and to reduce that stigma associated with seeking help and providing help to students. We know that research tells us that students are more likely to seek help from their peer before they're going to go to our really fantastic resources on campus, so we're trying to do what we can to strengthen those connections as well. The primary other part of our initiative is gatekeeper training. And gatekeeper, sometimes folks find that term a little bit off-putting, but it's the commonly used term for suicide prevention training programs that help folks identify suicide risk among people and then act appropriately. So we're really trying to target all campus community members to allow them to identify risk and do what they can to make the appropriate referrals, to provide a caring response. We're not asking community members in general to be clinicians. We know that we have those excellent resources on campus where we can refer people, but just to increase that awareness and to provide a caring response. So again, in about the last 2.5 years, we've trained over 1,000 student community members to be gatekeepers, and we've trained about 500 faculty and staff. We target each of those to those specific groups, and we've worked really closely with the Dean of Students Office, Student Health and Counseling, Residence Life, Student Affairs, I'm forgetting a lot of people, in order to really bring those resources together and to collaborate across campus. For faculty members in particular, we try to take a variety of approaches to really meet that faculty member where they are. Some faculty members are only comfortable providing a syllabus statement on their syllabus that references resources, and we think that that's a great first step. Other faculty members are happy to provide a referral to the care team, and we work with the care team to help promote that option. And some faculty members are even willing to say, hey, I'm worried about you, what can I do to help you? And that's fantastic as well. So we are nearing the end of our 3-year funding from SAMHSA, and so we have really been planning for sustainability for the Integrated Suicide Prevention Initiative activities over the past year or so. One thing that we did was support the creation of the Active Minds Club. So the students that you heard from a few minutes ago, we supported their startup and their development, and we're really pleased with some new directions, new ideas that they have to really continue those stigma reduction campaigns. It's been fantastic to be able to turn that over to the students in its entirety and to let them take direction on that. We've also provided a number of train the trainer events for gatekeeper trainers, and we have another one coming up in May. So for folks that are interested in providing those trainings to campus community members, we've been lucky enough to train Residence Life, all of the student health and counseling staff, and other students, faculty, and staff on campus to really pick up the heavy lifting of that training program across campus and continue to promote gatekeeper training for everybody so that everyone on our campus is prepared to recognize risk and to make those appropriate referrals or just to provide that caring response like I mentioned before. At the center, we also have a couple of suicide prevention research studies. We are conducting qualitative interviews with students who have seriously considered but never attempted suicide in order to help us understand what those protective factors are that are most effective for students who are at high risk. We are early in our analyses, but we continue to find that really having a connection to their peers and to their community is one of the strongest protective factors. So whatever we can do to continue to bolster that connected community certainly helps. And at the center, we have a couple of other training programs, including one new one that I was asked to talk about today. It's called the Arctic Aspert Program. So we are training healthcare professional students to prepare them to do screening, brief intervention, referral to treatment for alcohol and substance use disorders. So while we talk about having healthy minds, we're training our students, or we care about our students and their healthy minds, and we're also training them to be able to provide those services to other folks throughout our Alaska community more broadly in the future. So I don't know if I took all of my 5 minutes. I tried to go quickly there to buy us some time, and I will turn it over to Rebecca to talk about the PSC.
Okay, hello everybody. I'm gonna keep this brief as well. I brought along with me a couple bookmarks that if anybody is interested in getting some more details or you forget what I say to you in this quick blurb, I'll leave them on the back table for you. But I'm here on behalf of the Psychological Services Center, which is actually our clinical training center here in the Department of Psychology. We have student clinicians working in the PSC from our master's in clinical psychology program and our PhD program, providing clinical services to both our student population as well as the community in general. We do all sliding fee scale services there. We're one of two agencies in the community that provide services down to $0. So we do quite a service not only to our students but also to the community at large. We see all of the issues that everybody is talking about here today, so I'm not gonna go on about the kinds of things that we see in the clinic. But we do see a variety of different kinds of therapy there. It's a training clinic, so we do short-term therapy, longer-term therapies. We do refer out any active crisis situations. So that's what the PSC does. But I also wanted to take just a minute to say something beyond the PSC, because I don't tend to stick to what I'm supposed to talk about. But I actually appreciated the statement that Dean Stalvey made about focusing on wellness. I'm actually a graduate of the PhD program he was talking about. And I was very excited a couple speakers ago when we heard the students' voices up here. I highly, highly believe that the students are central to us addressing any of the issues that we're talking about here today. And engagement in the student body is essential to solutions. I know that I've been witnessing within the master's students in psychology and the doctoral students in psychology this emergence of theses and dissertations that are addressing student mental health and self-care kinds of issues, the same things that were just conversations that were happening several years ago, and conversations that to me as a student felt like they were not going to get addressed. They were just conversations that were happening. Students are stressed out, students are having problems, we don't know what to do about it, help. We need to have self-care programs and so forth, but students kind of felt like we didn't know how to do that because of the demands of our program. What I'm seeing happen right now is from the ground up, the students are starting to do the research that is going to address these very issues. And Bridget's work that she was talking about also is addressing and engaging the student population. So I guess that's really what I wanted to say more than anything is engage. We need to engage the students. The more we can hear student voices, I think the more we're going to make progress on the issues we're facing, and in the meantime, there's therapy available.
Well, thank you, everyone. We are running about 15 minutes behind schedule. I guess it's to be expected when you have excellent work. How can you possibly fit that into 5 minutes, right? The important part of today, other than sharing this information, is really the dialogue and the conversation at tables. And so what we'd like to do is to try and move a 30-minute conversation into a 10-minute conversation at your table, and then give you permission to take that conversation back to your office and to think more about that individually, and then to share that information with Pam Travis. Okay, if we could come back together. So again, I apologize for not having enough time for us to really get into the conversation like we had hoped for. But what I would like to do is just to have as many tables that can report out to do that.
with that first question I talked about, what would that look like on campus if we had Healthy Minds ethos? Would anyone like to share briefly? TJ.
Well, we had kind of a stacked table, but physical education folks here. Great conversation about the mind. We're missing 90% of the body. It's attached to the mind. We need to not just think healthy mind, we need to think whole person, wellness, holistic. We're totally separating the two, and they're not separated. So that was one of the biggest things about
Thank
today.
You.
So when you think about the body.
Thank you. Others.
So our group talked about promoting positive self-image and self-esteem, and regardless if the student is only here for a brief time, that we make sure that they have an experience that addresses their whole self and that it adds value to their life.
Thank you.
Judith. I'm going to go with the body-mind theme. More yoga, sitting around tables in the student union, ski trails around the university, plus more outdoor and indoor recreational opportunities that really do relieve a lot of that stress for people. The other thing, and we talked about a lot of things, but one other thing is, like the idea of student connections, like more places for them to hang out together, but also, you know, if we thought about those of us who have offices, if there were just more open doors, and if students really knew they could drop in.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Andre?
This group talked about two things to address that first question. Just an overall awareness of specific behaviors that might be problematic for a student on campus and having an awareness of what they look like, you know. And then an increased number of student-to-student interaction, and there was a suggestion of including online interaction that might help us get at some creative ways of dealing with it.
Healthy online interaction. Yeah.
Through social media,
thank you.
Perhaps.
Let's switch to the second question because I think that one's the one that has the real punch behind it. How can UAA better support your current and future work so that your contributions towards a Healthy Minds ethos are optimal? Any ideas? Yes.
We talked about having today's presentation provided for new faculty and staff orientations.
We talked a little bit about more collaborative efforts between the various departments of student affairs because many of us live in little micro silos within student affairs and academia. If we did more collaborative efforts and learn what each other does, we might be more useful to each other and ultimately help the students better.
Great. Thank you. Teresa.
We talked about expanding the resources in the Student Health and Counseling Center, their facility and their staff, in addition to an in-house wellness program.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yes.
It's nice to hear, isn't it?
Yeah.
The chick's in the mail, right?
One thing that's quite concerned me, and I've been a bit surprised by, is I think we should have very, very strong student societies. I'm in the Faculty of Education, and I expect that there to be an Education Student Society, which sits on all of your major committees, which has both graduate and undergraduate input. And I have not found that. Now, I don't know about everybody else's colleges and centers, but that is a thing which gives people both political, communication skills, you name it. They learn so many things in a safe place, and they get respect from the faculty. It's not just churning out degrees and higher qualifications. It's about learning all the rules that it takes, and it leads to community engagement. That's the part that John and I will go.
Thank you. One of the key determinants of student success and student completion and retention is interaction with faculty.
Yep.
Thank you. Dr. Lee can help you with how to establish a society for your educators with your student life and leadership. One more idea?
Just one topic that I don't think the others raised, being culturally sensitive and culturally responsive.
Can you share just a little bit more about that?
Well, I was trying to tuck it in here because that's the question we're on, but we actually addressed it more in the first question in terms of what ways would UAA be different, and we would be considering that in the way that we respond to some of these issues that we talked about today.
Important. Thank you. Thank you. Our time is up today. I wanted to thank all of you for attending today. I don't think that we really anticipated to have such a large turnout. It says a lot for this conversation, that this conversation needs to continue. A round of applause again for our presenters.
This podcast was brought to you by the University of Alaska Anchorage. Listen to and download podcasts at greenandgold.uaa.alaska.edu/podcasts. Do you have an event you'd like recorded? Contact University Advancement at aynews@uaa.alaska.edu or 786-4847.